I felt like time slowed down and I was just wondering, what am I going to land on? Is this going to be it? Or, you know, am I going to stop anytime soon? And then I just, boom, hit the ground and continued just tomahawking down the entire thing until I stopped.
Welcome back to The Fine Line, where we share real stories of adventure, risk, and rescue from the backcountry of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I'm Matt Hansen. To begin Season 8, we're bringing you a story from one of the most recognizable features of the Southern Teton Range, and a ski line that makes even the bravest skiers buckle their boots a little bit tighter. Cody Peaks, Central Kolar. Our story begins on the sunny Saturday afternoon of March 18th, 2023, when two skiers decided to drop into Central. It ends with the two of them reflecting on how the outcome may have changed their relationship to skiing and their approach to big, complex mountains. During our conversation, we'll wrestle with questions about the allure of dangerous ski terrain, how fear plays an integral part of steep skiing, and how there is a razor-sharp line between letting that fear consume you or set you free. We'll also hear how the partnership between the Jackson Hole Ski Patrol and Teton County Search and Rescue was born out of necessity when the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort thrust open their backcountry gates in the winter of 1999-2000, a move that ushered in a new era of big mountain skiing and riding in the United States and forever changed the rescue profile for our local first responders. The Fine Line is produced by Backcountry Zero, a project of the Teton County Search and Rescue Foundation to eliminate fatalities and serious injuries in the Tetons. You can support this project and the volunteers at Teton County Search and Rescue by making a donation at tetoncountysar.org/donate. The interviews were recorded in the studios of KHOL 89.1 FM in Jackson. For more news and stories about Jackson Hole, make sure you subscribe to Jackson Unpacked, a weekly podcast produced by our partners at KHOL. And just so you know, this episode references the challenges of mental health and may be triggering for some listeners. If you need help or know someone who does, please call the National Crisis and Suicide Prevention Hotline of 988. No matter where you live, help is available, and it's okay to not be okay. As always, we are deeply grateful for the people who come onto the Fine Line to share their stories so that the rest of us can learn from their experiences. Our story from one of the steepest and most visible ski lines in Jackson Hole begins right after this.
Hey, it's Liz Barrett, brand director at Steo. We are excited to be the presenting sponsor of the Fine Line podcast. Based in Jackson and fueled by our life here in the Tetons, Steo was founded to inspire connection with the outdoors through premium technical apparel. We live and love the mountain life, and we see ourselves as caretakers of the resources that provide it. Rooted in sustainability and inclusivity, Steo has partnered with like-minded organizations such as Teton County Search and Rescue, Coombs Outdoors, and Protect Our Winters to help them advance their mission. Through this work, we hope to inspire people to get outside and come home safely at the end of the day. 9 winters ago, I moved to Jackson to work for Steo, and to ski more, to bike more, to camp more, to be closer to nature. I feel fortunate to call this place my home, and through my work at Steo, I feel lucky to support the stories of the inspiring individuals that make up this vibrant community. For more stories on the mountain life, visit Steo's Mountain Town Journal at steo.com.
So we're at the top of Cody Peak and nervous, excited, the whole thing. And we put our skis on our back and we down climb into the couloir. And as we were putting our skis on, we both kind of reminded each other, this is a no fall zone. My name is Jacqueline Dickey, and I grew up in Houston, currently live in Salt Lake City. Learned to ski also as a toddler, around 4 years old, went to Colorado. My dad would plop me in between his skis and ski. I would be holding his hands on the way down. And I'm a doctor. I'm finishing up my internal medicine residency, starting cardiology fellowship in July. Skiing is really attractive to me because you get to be outside. You can always challenge yourself. There's always really phenomenal people around and seeing the abilities of people and feeling yourself be able to do more technical lines and kind of have goals and be able to hike up to them and ski down them yourself without really the help of technology or motors has been really fun. It's like a physical, mental challenge. I think skiing is the purest form of euphoria that I feel in my life.
It's always been a feeling of freedom, and a connection to the outdoors, a connection to nature, to being able to see a line and go make it happen, to not feeling like I am bound by any sort of set of rules, and just getting to be out there alone, making happiness for myself. My name is Will Brown. I was born in Dallas, Texas. First time I was on skis, I was 18 or 20 months old. My dad picked me up and put me on the front of his skis on a family ski trip and fell in love as early on as I can remember. Grew up skiing in Taos, New Mexico, 7 to 10 days a year on family trips. I am about to be finished being a lawyer, set to join a startup. That move was partially spurred by this accident. So I'm joining a startup called Myoni Genius that helps high school kids figure out their place in the world and who they are and who they want to be. Last winter, at the time of the accident, I was living in Driggs.
Cody Peak is, you know, the most prominent thing you can see once you right outside the mountain resort boundary. And the thing that you notice the most about Cody Peak is the cleaving right down the center of it from the top, which is Central Couloir. My name is Jeff Burke. I was born and raised in Sioux City, Iowa, and I grew up skiing on the small little hills of Cherokee, Iowa, and Mount Cato, Minnesota. I moved out to Jackson when I was 23. I've been living out here since 1996 full-time, and I've been working on the Jackson Hole Ski Patrol for, this is my 18th season. There's a lot of other things alongside it that flank it, like No Shadows, Four Shadows, Pucker Face, Powder 8 Faces. They're all great. But Central is probably what draws your eyes right away. And it kind of shows you the scale and the scope of what you're getting into when you think of Jackson Hole. You know, it's been there for a long time. The gates opened in 2000. Prior to that, the ski patrol was in charge of opening it under low avalanche hazard conditions, and people have been going out there since the 70s. The first person to ski Central Couloir was Larry Dietrich, one of my mentors on ski patrol. And I might not get the date right, but I think I was told it was 1976. And he was a longtime ski patroller and a really good mentor to a lot of us who have come up underneath his, you know, tenure at the mountain resort. And, you know, that's kind of a nice feather in your cap.
Skiing something steep is kind of the only thing that you can do to get that feeling of flying almost. And then just to keep improving as a skier, you know, getting in the backcountry, having knowledge of mountains and wanting to do something more technical so I could keep improving as a skier in incremental ways.
Central Couloir is something that it's very, very visible, and it's something that I'd been looking at since I first came to Jackson in 2015. And it's also a line that isn't skiable every year. And so I'd been looking at the line since 2015. I'd been passing on the line every year since. And last winter was just a bomber snow year. I mean, we had a ton of snow, and it was a pretty stable snowpack. And so all winter I was paying attention to how the line was filling in, what the snowpack was doing, paying attention to the snow with the idea of skiing Central. It was something that I wanted to do last winter. And then Jackie texted me, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks before that day, saying that she was coming up with friends. And I was like, great, if the forecast lines up, would you be interested in skiing Central Couloir with me? I wanted to do it with the right partner. As she said, we've skied a lot together. We've skied a lot of steep terrain together. We feed off of each other. I feel like we've made good decisions together. And so she's somebody that I wanted to ski it with. And as the day drew nearer, the forecast kept giving us green lights. And so it we woke up that morning with the plan to go out and hike Cody, and we were looking at it from the tram and then from the hike over there, kind of talking about it, and everything said go. There were no red flags, and so we passed Pucker, we passed No Shadows, we passed Four Shadows. We had another person in our group who peeled off. He skied No Shadows, and we said, we're going to go give it a look. So it was a beautiful day. Sun was shining, limited wind, really pleasant hike out there. And we got up to the entrance, and I remember, and we had talked about this before, but I remember talking about it then, that it's truly a no-fall zone. If you fall, it's a top-to-bottom fall. And so I think that that was certainly in my mind going into it. I felt like we had discussed the consequences and were both ready to push ourselves. And it was something that we felt like we could do, but it was certainly at the edge of our comfort zone.
In the morning, I was really excited, as I always am, and I was really excited to be with Will and skiing, you know, a line that we had been excited about. But on the way up, I felt nervous, and I hadn't typically felt nervous before skiing lines. There were certain areas where we were kind of climbing up and scrambling and in our ski boots, and I was like, oh man, I feel kind of unsteady right now for some reason. But once we got along the ridgeline, it was, the sun was shining and it was beautiful. And like Will said, it wasn't too windy, and it was a really nice hike after we got over the kind of rock scrambling.
From the top of Central Kular, the skiers encountered a sheer wall of snow, with footsteps kicked into the side of a big cornice that overhangs the peak. Leaving their skis attached to their backpacks, they downclimbed about 15 feet into the couloir, clinging to the face with only their boot tips.
Well, certainly looked like you had to downclimb. So probably 15 feet or so of sheer vertical. It had been skied before. There was a pretty nice set of steps down into it. I went first and went down the down climb. We put our skis on. In addition to saying this is a no-fall zone, I remember looking down and getting this feeling of I'm about to do something big, and turning to Jackie and saying, wow, do you feel that? Like, that's what lets me know that I'm alive. And it was, I mean, it's, Jackson Hole is steep. Central Kular is another level. It is like nothing that I'd ever seen before in terms of steepness. Hard to describe, but looks damn near vertical.
I never seriously considered turning around, but again, today was kind of, or that day was uncharacteristically nerve-wracking for me. And on the climb up, I said to our other friend, Andy, "Whew, I'm feeling pretty nervous." And he said, "You can always turn around." But in my head, I was like, I didn't come here to ski open stuff, even if it's steep. Like, I came out here to ski Central Kular, and that's what I'm going to ski.
It was a space only for one. So I put my skis on first and then skied out a little bit into the run and let Jackie put her skis on. I was like, oh shit, like, don't drop a ski down, because then we're really screwed. So yeah, it was a little bit of a relief once I got my skis on, and then I looked over the edge and saw what I was about to do, and that relief was short.
I wanted to get my skis on as quickly as possible. For that reason, I just feel much more comfortable on skis than balancing on the tips of my boots dug into the snow on this essentially vertical couloir that we were in.
And so I did 5, 6, 7 jump turns, and then pulled off to the side to allow Jackie to come down after me.
I had bought a new helmet that season. Kind of splurged on a helmet, thankfully, and goggles, gloves. We were both wearing packs with you know, beacon shovel probe, water, extra snacks, layers. So when I started skiing, I will add that I think the nervousness that I keep talking about, I think I was second guessing a few things, like, did I choose the right skis today? And should we be in this? The top was pretty windblown, so I felt kind of, oof, a little bit unsteady. And I think the fact that I was second guessing a lot of things and feeling kind of scared made me ski worse. So I started skiing scared. And, you know, when you're skiing scared, you do silly things that you can't really afford to do in a tight couloir, such as pointing your ski tips uphill. You know, that might catch on a rock and then you fall. Maybe traversing a little bit too far with each turn instead of just jumping. So, you know, Will went down a pretty short pitch and I felt like, okay, it's still pretty open up here. So I took my turn with the jump turns and I think made it pretty safely to you for that at least first pitch.
Yeah, we did have one successful pitch. That was the second part that we skied. We gathered ourselves and got ready for that choke point, which is harder from scoping it out from afar, from looking at pictures of it. It's hard to appreciate how narrow that pinch is. It's rocky, it's icy. There was not wide enough for a set of whatever my skis are, 180s, to get through sideways, and probably not, you know, unless you're on little ski blades, you can't get through it sideways.
So looking at the pinch and knowing that that was kind of what we needed to get through for our next pitch, if you will, I maybe took a couple more jump turns and then my ski tips crossed and I panicked and I tried to correct it, but since I was kind of panicked, I picked up my bottom ski and that got stuck under my top ski and made me lose my balance. I landed uphill on my stomach and tried to self-arrest, but it is so steep that I just couldn't, and I felt like I was clawing. I just started to accelerate. I knew once I accelerated to a certain degree that I was not going to stop until I got to the bottom. And I had my first thought was my family's going to be so sad, because I truly, you know, I had looked down at it, I had looked up at it, and I was like, there's no way you can fall and make it through this. So I fell past Will through the pinch. Our friend Andy was at the bottom looking up, and he said that I essentially ping-ponged off the walls back and forth and kind of looked like I had gone a little bit limp. And in my head, I just was thinking the whole time, so many different thoughts, but when is this gonna stop? What's coming next? What should I be doing right now? And at one point, I assume it's when we were going over, or when I was going over the mandatory exit cliffs, I was tomahawking at that point. And I felt like I was suspended in the air for a very long time. I must have launched off something at mid-somersault. I felt like time slowed down and I was just wondering, what am I gonna land on? Is this gonna be it? Or, you know, am I gonna stop anytime soon? Then I just, boom, hit the ground and continued just tomahawking down the entire thing until I stopped. But I do remember at one point maybe seeing some snow around me, and I felt like I knew at that point, okay, I'm in the bowl at the end. I'm kind of in this place of safety, but I knew I wasn't stopping until I got to the bottom. Once I stopped falling, I could not believe that I was alive. And my friend Andy was trying to get over to me as quickly as possible, but he said I just laid there for a second. And after I stopped falling, the rest is a little bit fuzzy, but I do remember everything for the most part. And, he was saying, oh my gosh, did I just watch my friend die? Because he was far enough away that he couldn't really see what was going on. And then he said, all of a sudden, I just sat up, popped up, and was kind of sitting there.
I was still above that pinch point. I saw her fall. When she came past me, she was kind of perpendicular to the slopes. Her skis would have been parallel. Her butt was going downhill. And I just remember saying, get your skis downhill. And then after she fell over the pinch point, I didn't see her, but I saw the speed with which she was falling and knew that she would fall all the way to the bottom. As we've discussed, you know, it's a total no-fall zone, certainly something that where a fall could be fatal. My emotions shut off. I went into total survival mode. I knew that, you know, one person falling could potentially be tragic. Don't make it two. And just went into, you know, control what you can control, and that's getting down this safely. But afterwards, I felt a whole lot of shame about turning into survival mode and to not being concerned about whether Jackie had survived the fall or not, you know, sort of shamed about the fact that I was able to continue skiing. Like, what's wrong with me that I'm able to see potentially one of my good friends die and I'm still skiing?
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Ski Patroller Jeff Burke will explain how rescues come together in the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort backcountry.
Hey everyone, Max Schaefer here, brewmaster for Roadhouse Brewing Company. One of my favorite things to do when I come out of the backcountry is to swing by our brew pub, Roadhouse Pub and Eatery on the town square in downtown Jackson, Wyoming, to share stories and snacks and to raise a glass to a fun, memorable, and safe trip. All of us at Roadhouse Brewing Company are excited to bring you this episode of The Fine Line and remind you to stay safe out there and to never be late to happy hour. You can now find Roadhouse beers across the Mountain West, West Coast, and we are constantly expanding distribution. Learn more at roadhousebrewery.com.
You know, Jackson's been one of those places where you separate yourself from the predetermined outcomes of ski resorts and you go out and experience the wilds. And we have the terrain for it, and we have good guides and good local talent that all like to go out into the backcountry and, you know, experience Mother Nature on her terms. And it's alluring and it's addictive, and we all have moved to ski towns to do that. This just happens to be one of the main ones, and it's been growing for a long time, and there's a visceral connection that we all have with going out and doing these things. And with that, you're going to have misadventure. And when misadventure happens, you know, we have to have protocols and personnel that are put into place to help people that get injured or, you know, worse.
After the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort opened their backcountry gates more than 20 years ago, there became a need for different responding agencies to come together for the inevitable rescues. Ever since, Jackson Hole Ski Patrol has been working hand-in-hand with Teton County Search and Rescue and Grand Teton National Park anytime there is an emergency in the resort's surrounding backcountry. In these cases, Ski Patrol will respond out of bounds and simultaneously notify Teton County Search and Rescue or Grand Teton National Park. Most of the time, Ski Patrol can handle the calls themselves if someone is just lost, for instance. For bigger events that require more resources, Ski Patrol will work with TCSAR volunteers and Grand Teton National Park climbing rangers to resolve the situation. The same coordination happens over at Grand Targhee on the west side of the Tetons and at Snow King Mountain in Jackson. All three ski areas are within Teton County, Wyoming, which requires a seamless partnership among the different agencies during a backcountry emergency. If it sounds complicated, that's because it is, with so many different layers of first responders working together. But that's why they train together, so that everybody knows what to do when they get that phone call.
When we respond out of bounds with the two people who can do a hasty search, find out what's going on, we can then relay back to the mountain station and find out what other materials and personnel we need, and then we can decide if we need additional resources in the form of TCSAR or the Grand Teton Climbing Rangers. Basically, to respond out of bounds is, it's kind of a privilege. You want to be able to do it. You want to do a good job. You want to represent your team very well, and it's not taken lightly. So you know, it's usually one of the first things in the room is stop. What are we doing? Who's going? What do we expect they're going to find? We get a big dry erase marker board and someone basically runs and is the note taker. And they basically are scribing everything, the times that things get called in, how the situation is updating or how it's, you know, improving, digressing. And we keep all of that while the dispatcher is regulating some of the other things that are going on the mountain in addition to the rescue out of bounds.
One of the first people to arrive on scene was Dr. Jeff Greenbaum, the medical director for the Jackson Hole Ski Patrol. From Mountain Station at the top of the tram, he had seen Jacqueline fall, and he knew that she would likely need medical attention.
We hiked up just below Pucker Face, and it was me and Dylan Elder. Dylan Elder carried the suck bag, and then we traversed, followed Dr. Greenbaum's line as far as we could, and then bootpacked up to Jacqueline, and then there was a couple other bystanders there, and we basically packaged her there.
Once I stopped falling and I was sitting in the snow, I was aware that people were coming towards me eventually, but for a second, I just remember looking out and kind of having tunnel vision and feeling woozy. In hindsight, I was probably dizzy from somersaulting so far. And I saw Andy because he was calling to me. He was, you know, saying, stay awake, talk to me, tell me what's going on, as he kind of skied over to me. And he got to me first and said, what's bothering you the most? What's the worst injury? And my shoulder was kind of hanging out of its socket. So it was my shoulder. And then Dr. Greenbaum appeared, and this all seemed like it happened pretty quickly, but I think from talking to Will, it actually was a much longer time, but my perception of time was off. So Dr. Greenbaum appeared and put my shoulder back in place, and then another emergency medicine doctor appeared, and they were putting their jackets on me because I was shaking uncontrollably. And then a neurosurgeon appeared and was saying, look at me, and was checking my pupils and my C-spine. And I was like, where are all these people coming from? And what a great response team. And then I could see Ski Patrol in my kind of tunnel blurry vision coming towards me at that point.
I can't remember exactly what was reported on your injuries, but the mechanism was there in and of itself from Greenbaum's initial call in that we were going to go out there with at least a suck bag, because a suck bag allows us to put you in something that's secure and a little bit warming, so to speak. And then Tim Seal-Carlin and Carol View came in with Steve. They landed below Four Shadows, and there's a nice little kind of mound, pitcher's mound of snow that was open, and it was easy for us to just diagonal down to her with four patrollers just carrying it down and using the suck bag as its own kind of sled, which is smooth and it doesn't strain anybody, and then get him onto the litter or get him off of that, because we just put it right into the ship that way.
Yeah, so the only reason I know that my right shoulder came out is because of the x-rays and MRIs that came afterwards. And the orthopedic surgeon I saw said, you have matching injuries on the right and left side, and it's because you dislocated both of your shoulders. So I assume that I dislocated my right shoulder at some point on the way down, and then it just from the trauma popped back into place, and then my left shoulder had dislocated and was still dislocated by the time I stopped. I thought it would be painful to have my shoulder put back in place, but Dr. Greenbaum was incredibly gentle, and I was nervous, and I was like, oh, this is going to hurt, this is going to hurt. And he said, I'm not going to hurt you. And he just very gently put it back into place. There wasn't any dramatic pop or scream. It just, the pain went away, the really, really distracting all-encompassing pain went away once it was back in place, and I felt so relieved.
Then it was pretty much straightforward. Package her, get her to the helicopter, get her down to the valley floor, and then to the clinic, or to the hospital, rather. The other thing that we were thinking about the whole time is, like, looking up at Will and being like, what are we going to do with this guy? Does he want to ski out of the Kular? We don't know. We know that you were talking, I think you were talking with Sparky.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, we're like, okay, it's getting kind of late. And, you know, for the record, Teton County Search and Rescue does have 1,000-foot rope at the top of Cody in case of, you know, having to come get anybody who, and nobody would blame you for being like, I don't want to make this jump at the bottom. We should also talk about the jump at the bottom.
Let's talk about the jump at the bottom.
The jump at the bottom is big. It's blind. And it's typically no joke. And so I feel for you in the sense that, you know, here you are. You can kind of see us performing the rescue. And the only thing between us and you is a 25-foot blind cliff to a landing that you don't really know is going to be good or bad. Great.
Yeah, so I made it over the choke and started seeing poles and skis left behind, and so I thought I better pick these up so that the next skier doesn't get taken out by a pole or a ski. So collected both of her poles and shoved those in between my pack and my back, and then got one of her skis also, and then found what felt like the flattest part up there to perch myself, knowing that there's no way to do the mandatory air with, an accident scene unfolding below. It wasn't flat at all, but dug my edges in and kind of posted up in the couloir with one of her skis, both of her poles, and then the first person to contact me was Ski Patrol. Andy had my number. I'd skied with Andy once before, but I'm really glad that he had my number. So a little tip going forward is everybody in your ski party should have everybody's number. So he was able to relay that to Ski Patrol. They called me, said, you know, stay put, got it. And they told me sort of what the next steps would be, that they'd be out to assess the scene. Helicopter would likely be on the way. And then the next person I heard from was Search and Rescue, kind of the same thing, giving me an update. They're on their way. Stay put. Certainly, once you see the helicopter, don't move, because I gather that would be quite dangerous to be moving while the helicopter was in the air. And I skied down low enough to where I was able to call out to Andy, and we were able to communicate, not well, but in shouts, to where I knew that Jackie was alive. So that was certainly comforting to know, and I think my sense of time slowed down. Everything felt like it was taking forever because I was really anxious. I was holding my edges. My legs were tired, and I was concerned and felt pretty helpless up there. It was not a great feeling to know that the best thing that I could do was nothing. Yeah, so they were definitely in contact with me asking if I felt comfortable skiing out, and I think part of it was a pride thing. Like, of course I'm fine skiing out. And part of it was not wanting to feel like a burden. You know, the search and rescue is for people who are injured, and I wasn't injured. So I felt like I hadn't earned the right to be rescued. I also hadn't tried to start skiing again until after, like, while we were on the phone. And I'd been holding my edges for close to 2 hours, and my legs were shot. And so it was definitely a suffer fest to make those turns and get out of it, and certainly didn't approach the mandatory air with any speed because I just couldn't link turns together. Hucked myself off of there, and it wasn't pretty, but made it out without any injuries. And I'm glad that I didn't take the offer to be helped out of there. There was another rescue that day. The helicopter was needed. I didn't know that at the time, but looking back on it, I mean, that's why I didn't take the offers, because I felt like there could have been somebody who needed it more. I mean, I was looking forward to doing the air before the accident, so it's still something that I wanted to do. Certainly didn't do it the way that I wanted to, but I got out of there. Yep. I had collected the skis, which we just found. Jackie was just reunited with her skis today. They'd been up there, I guess, all winter. But yeah, I knew that I couldn't do the air with the skis on my back, and so I hucked those over. Skier's left over, there's a ridge line there, so threw them over skier's left so that nobody would hit them. And then, yeah, I had quite the party for a not very graceful air. I think that is more of where I was in my state of mental health at the time. And so I certainly can see that now. At the time, I was not in a great place. I remember as I was up there holding my edges thinking, well, if Jackie didn't make it, then, like, I could end it and people would understand. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly wasn't in a good place mentally. And I think that's maybe part of what drew me to Central, is that I knew what the consequences were and I was totally at peace with, or not at peace, but I maybe saw that, like, the worst case scenario is not that bad. After the accident, I think that the house of cards that was my mental health came crashing down, and was forced to do a whole lot of introspection and working through some of the shame that I talked about with being able to see a friend potentially die and ski fine and be able to put that out of my mind. I know, like, looking back on it, that was a blessing, to be able to get into that mindset of survival mode. But yeah, I think that it's totally changed my approach to skiing. Not necessarily the accident, but the work that came after that. You know, not seeing myself as a burden is certainly one of the things that I've worked through. I think, but living in the Tetons, it's certainly a place where people are badass and people push. And I felt like I needed to feel like I belonged. I felt like I needed to push and to be that badass, and that, you know, I'd be worthy of connection if I could ski the next big line. Then somebody would want to hear what I had to say. And I've certainly come to realize that I'm valuable purely for the fact that I exist. You know, I don't need to go ski Central. I don't need to do a backflip off of Corbett's to be worth having a conversation with. So I think that as I've come back to skiing, I'm doing it for myself, not for anybody else, not for how I think that I'll be received, not so that I can talk about it. I do it as an escape from the daily grind, as a connection to myself and as a connection to nature, rather than as a way to prove something to somebody. I've realized that in trying to do that, it's a moving target, because sure, I'd ski Central and I wouldn't have found connection because I skied Central. And so then it would have just been the next thing. Yeah, skiing isn't about checking things off the list or posting about it on Instagram or talking about it at the bar. It's about connecting with nature and challenging myself and enjoying it.
By the time I was in the helicopter, I felt like my job's over, I'm being taken care of. It felt like I was in capable hands and I was gonna get to the emergency department and that was next on the list, and what I did wouldn't impact the outcome. And yes, I was very cold. I don't know where it came from. Maybe just the adrenaline and stress, but I just remember shaking uncontrollably. Steve, the search and rescue pilot that day, said he was flying the helicopter and he felt like it was shaking. And he said, you know, what's going on? Is like something off rotation, or, you know, what is that feeling? And he looked back and saw me just shivering uncontrollably. This is in my ski gear. I think I had maybe two or three other ski jackets that were dedicated to me and wrapped around me, and a space blanket. and I just could not stop shivering. I mean, I had a black eye. I had massive bruises all over myself. I still have some scars on my legs from just cutting them open. But I got a concussion. My helmet is absolutely banged up. It's just dented on the front, back, sides, top. And I tore my labrum in both of my shoulders. I tore a couple muscles in my rotator cuff on the left side. Probably knocked up and bruised some of the muscles in my back and maybe my ribs, because it was a little bit hard to breathe for a few days after that. There was evidence of muscle breakdown in my urine and a little bit of blood. I had a laceration on my elbow that was nearly down to the joint space, so they had to wash it out at bedside and start me on a course of antibiotics. The concussion was made things difficult because it was hard to focus at work and concentrate on what I was doing and recall information well. And the shoulder injuries just made everything hard. I mean, I had to set an alarm 20 minutes earlier every morning so that I could allow time to get dressed. And turning the steering wheel was hard. Reaching for the buckle to buckle myself in was hard. And so I was driving slower and just allowing time for me to function in my daily life and get to work and kind of go to work and pretend like nothing happened. My approach to mountains in general, skiing, is that I think before the fall, I had two check boxes. Do I think I can do it? Yes. Do I want to do it? Yes. Done. That was the end of the equation. I would prepare for the day and I would do it. But now I think serious injury and death are no longer hypothetical things. Just from feeling like in the moment, this could be how I die. So I think just risk mitigation as far as choosing lines now, thinking about if I were to fall, is there a feature at some point in this couloir where I could maybe slow down or stop falling? How long is the couloir and how steep is it? You know, I think staying under 50 degrees is a pretty good goal, if not less steep. And just assessing the risk on a more granular level, anticipating that if the worst were to happen, what would the outcome be? And if the outcome is more than likely death, probably not doing it. I am still interested in skiing couloirs, and I should put earmuffs on my parents for that statement. Will mentioned a while ago, earlier, that he turned to me and said, "This is how I know I'm alive." And I think that really feeling like there's not a hard line in the sand, and that, you know, if I prepare more, if I train more, if I become more knowledgeable, I can keep challenging myself. And I don't feel content just saying, okay, the way I ski now is the best I'll ever be. I want to continue to improve with skiing, and I want to continue challenging myself. And unfortunately, the challenges are probably going to be in couloirs, but again, really assessing risk and not accepting certain levels of risk that perhaps I would have before the fall. Other lessons learned and things I could have done differently. I mean, I think the fact that I felt so nervous because I was using different equipment than I was used to skiing. I mean, I had not skied on these skis very many times, and they were fatter and longer than I was used to, and never felt 100% comfortable on them. I think that's where a lot of the fear came from in retrospect, was just these conditions. It's icy, it's windblown up here. Are these the right conditions? Am I using the right equipment? I think if you have that feeling of uncharacteristic nervousness, to just, when the consequences are that high, just go back the next day, or go back in a month, or go back next season. But that feeling is coming from somewhere. I really had never felt that nervous going into a line. And to be fair, it was the biggest line I would have ever done. But I think I knew that, and I knew that I hadn't maximized or optimized my, you know, everything for that day. Knowledge, equipment, weather, etc.
A lot of skiing is mental. And you know, if I'm not feeling like a great connection to folks, if I'm feeling kind of down, skiing something where the consequences are possibly fatal is not a good idea. And so I think that going into that day, I hadn't been being honest with myself. I hadn't been having those conversations with myself. There's still, even after doing all the work that I did after the accident, there's still certainly days where I don't feel 100%. And those are days that I'm going to ski groomers, or I'm going to go for a run. And so in addition to making sure that I'm physically ready for something of a lot of consequence, I'm also making sure that I'm mentally ready.
I don't know that my advice is the best, because I may have had an unhealthy relationship with fear, but I loved that feeling. And typically the way I would approach it is, it'll be fine. I've done stuff like this before. I know I can do this. This will be the next challenge accomplished, and then I can create another challenge for myself and just do it. I mean, and now I'm actually having to pump the brakes and say, maybe I should listen to the fear more often.
If you go into something thinking you're going to pull it off, that can be an asset. You know, you've already visualized, I'm doing this. And if you go in visualizing that this is going to, all hell's going to break loose on my fifth turn, well, then that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I feel like once you're in it, you just have to trust that, you have to trust your ability. And because I second guessed that, I changed the way I was skiing into a more dangerous kind of skiing. And once you're inside of the couloir, that's not a good place to second guess yourself, because it does mess with your abilities at that point.
Thank you for listening to The Fine Line. That was Jacqueline Dickey, along with Will Brown and Jeff Burke. Our editing is by Melinda Binks. Our theme song is by Anne and Pete Sibley, with additional music provided by Ben Winship. The original cover art is by Jen Reddy, and my name is Matt Hansen. This podcast is produced by Backcountry Zero, a project of the Teton County Search and Rescue Foundation to eliminate fatalities and serious injuries in the Tetons. We'll be back in your feed with a new episode in a couple weeks. Learn more at backcountryzero.com.
Yeah. How'd you get these?
They melted out in the summer. Imagine that. And we went and got them.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Dude.
Reed Finley and Tyler McPhee are the ones that actually got them.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was just saying I wanted these for the memories.
Oh, and now you have them.
Yeah.
Nice.
Those are awesome.
Wow, thank you so much.
We met on the hill briefly before, but you probably don't remember me too much.
Maybe not.
That's all right.
Once I stopped falling, everything's...
I bet.
Fuzzy after that.
I bet. Right. Well, my name's Jeff.
Jacqueline.
Nice to meet you officially.
Yeah.
I'm Will.
Will, you are the one up in the couloir the whole time.
Yep.
Nice patience, dude.
Thanks.